Well, it's been a quiet week in Lake Wobegon, Minnesota, my hometown. Out there on the edge of the prairie, it's been cold, and that snow that is on the ground is now there to stay, and we're happy about that. The pine trees and the spruce trees have a little decorative snow on them, and butter is selling for $1.89 a pound, and eggs for 89 cents a dozen. They ran out of butter twice this last week, so the baking has begun for Christmas already. People making cookies and the like. They're just a little thin skin of ice on the lake. You don't even want to think about going out there. And the Sidetrack Tap is offering a Christmas punch that they say no sensible person should venture more than 2 coffee cups of it. So we shall see. It's the big moon tonight, the full moon. It's the long night moon, and this bright moonlight wakes people up in the middle of the night. Moonlight, 2 a.m. in the morning, and you get up and you think these long thoughts that you would not think at other times of the year. People who sleep like logs, now they sleep like tall grass, and they wake up thinking about that scoutmaster who used to take them winter camping and who told them that the best way to treat hypothermia is to strip the clothes off the victim, and then you take off your own clothes and you lie next to that person naked in a sleeping bag. We've been thinking about that man for a while, wondering where he is now, wondering what he is up to, thinking about that evangelist who came up from Tulsa, Oklahoma, came up in December. He was led by the Spirit, but evidently the Spirit hadn't looked at the weather forecasts. He wasn't used to cold weather. Came all the way up to Lake Wobegon. Brother Barnum was his name. He had his hair very beautifully parted in the middle, and he had a brushy red mustache, and he went around tying fish line around people's wrists and saying words over them. He was charismatic, not that we would know charismatic. I mean, we're Lutherans, but he appeared to believe that he was charismatic, and he had tremendous faith until it started to get really, really cold that year, and they had to put him under quilts and put weights on him to keep him from shivering. He could not even bathe himself. He couldn't brush his own teeth. He was shaking so hard. Finally, they had to take up a collection and put him on a train and send him back to his sister in Florida, because he was just so miserable. Had to pay 2 fat ladies to sit on either side of him to keep him warm going down there. And when he got down to Florida, he found that he had lost his faith, and he could not reconcile winter in Minnesota with the idea of a loving God. He could not put them together. So he mastered the art of shuffling cards, the double shuffle. He learned how to do it and how to put the card that you wanted in a place where you could find it when it was useful to you. And he made his living playing Texas draw in the back room of hotels. He found some women, some fat, some thin, to comfort him. And last we heard, he was running for Congress. So it was his inspiration in a way. That was a terrible, bitter winter. What year was that? I think it was 1975. It was the year that the Empire Builder was stuck stranded out in the middle of North Dakota for 2 weeks back in December 1975. Children were conceived on that train. It was that bad. That's how bad it was. They finally got free. But those children, some of them have formed an Empire Builder Child Society, and they have reunions every year. They come back. The most recent one was in Lake Wobegon. There they were. They were just infants back in 1975, 76. They were born in 76, conceived in 75, born in the fall of 76. And here they are, just young, confused people in their late 30s wandering around town belonging to an organization which is based simply on the idea of their conception. Kind of an odd thing, odd to have them around. There was one of them walking around town leaving big tracks across people's backyards. People thought it was a prowler. It wasn't. It was just a man brooding about why he had been born. The unanswerable question. Now people think about these things when there's a full moon on a winter night. They think about Aunt Cooter. I think about Aunt Cooter, who wasn't even related to us. She was just a poor, unfortunate old lady who came to stay with us. We were Christians, so we had to offer hospitality, but we thought that other Christians would pick up the slack and we'd be able to pass her around. And no, they felt that she was so comfortable with us and she belonged to us. Somehow, I don't know what made them think that. She was a real pain in the wazoo and made you think twice about offering charity to somebody. The needy can be really unpleasant sometimes. She sat in a corner by the chimney and listened to the wind up there, and she would just moan along, "Oh, this will be my last winter, I'm sure." Well, as it turned out, it was. We were not unhappy about that. No, she had two teeth in her mouth. Her food had to be pre-chewed for her, which sounds like a greater pleasure than it is. Sat there wrapped in an old quilt, and then she got hallucinations and she could see Jesus outside the window out in the snowdrifts walking on snow. In scripture he walks on water, but anyway, he was walking on snow, and she thought he was coming for her, and she ran around from room to room, and then she was taking her clothes off and saying, I want the new raiment, she'd say. I want the new raiment. And when someone goes berserk and hallucinates like that, they become stronger and stronger. She's a little frail lady, but she's hard to get the clothes back on her. And if there was anybody who didn't even want to think about nude, it was Aunt Cooter. We wrapped her in quilts and put weights on her, and finally we had to tranquilize her, and I guess we over-medicated. It was a large pill, meant for a Percheron, but anyway, it was how she wanted to go. She wanted to go in her sleep, and Jesus was waiting for her somewhere, so it must have turned out all right for her. And then there was the problem of burying her, because it was so cold you couldn't put a pickaxe in the ground. Even if you put hot coals out on the turf, it still was frozen hard. You could only dig down about two, three inches, and she was skinny, but she needed more space than that. So we just stood her up in the woodshed, leaned her up against the wall, and she seemed content to stay there. Every so often her eyes would fly open and you'd go out there to get kindling, and she was there looking at you, and you had to try to shut them again. It was a great relief when spring came around. Spring came in, I think, June that year. Came in, and we were able to put her down in the ground. No, it's awkward when the moon is out like that. Irene Bunsen lay in bed thinking about her marriage. She and Clint had gone down to the Lutheran Men's Christmas tree lot to get a tree and resume their argument every year about what kind to get. And she's always wanted balsam and he's always wanted Scotch pine. So she was arguing for balsam, and he was agreeing with her. He said, fine, that's fine, that's fine. Well, she said, you don't like balsam, you like Scotch pine. No, he said, I've changed my mind. I like balsam now, the short-needled balsam. That's a beautiful tree. Well, she said, I think we better get a Scotch pine, because I don't want you to be unhappy and be moping and moody all through the holiday season. So we'll just get a Scotch. No, he said, here's a balsam right here. And he grabbed it and he paid for it. And then she, you know, had to criticize the shape of it and the branches and so on. But actually, it was perfect. So she didn't know. She missed that old little engagement she used to have with him. She'd been looking forward to it. She said, well, maybe we'd get one of each. No. Balsam is all we need. So they took it home, and she prepared to, you know, go on to the next argument, turkey versus goose, Christmas Eve versus Christmas for the big dinner. But he was perfectly agreeable, whatever she wanted. And she started to wonder what was going on. And she started to suspect that maybe he was carrying on with Darlene down at the Chatterbox Cafe. He's been spending a lot of time over his coffee, and he and Darlene have soulful conversations. And she went down to talk to Darlene, and she said, I just wonder if Clint isn't fooling around on the side. And Darlene laughed, this sarcastic, dismissive laugh, as if Clint were someone who no woman would find attractive enough. And it offended Irene. So that she has been boycotting the Chatterbox Cafe and intends to continue. And Dorothy asked her about it the other day. And how do you explain this? How do you explain this in just a sentence? That you're not going because you're insulted because the waitress thinks your husband incapable of adultery. Well, it's Christmas time. No time to be thinking about that. The Living Nativity returned to Our Lady of Perpetual Responsibility here last Sunday, actually. They were out there in front of Our Lady Church. They have that enormous creche, you know, with the moving parts. There's one cow that switches its tail, and the infant turns his head and holds up a hand, and the Blessed Virgin bows slightly. But those moving parts have broken, and there is no creche repairman in town, and people come to see this, and they're disappointed that those moving parts aren't moving anymore. And so Sister Arvon decided to have a living nativity and to go out and recruit. She went to the youth group in the Catholic Church and found young people who she could bend to her will. And she found Linda Magendanz to be the Blessed Virgin and Carl Schopenhauer to be Joseph. And those were the two, you know, for which you have certain unspoken standards, you know, the BVM and the BVJ, but in a small town, people know who qualifies for that and who does not. You know, I mean, it all has to do with the V, you know, and that does not stand for victorious. So they were all set, and there were some llamas who appeared in the role of camels, and there were some real sheep who were there who did not really want to be there, but there they were, and they were stuffed full of sweets, and all sorts of children. Shepherds were there. You don't care about their character whatsoever. They were, you know, some of them brought things to drink, and big robes, probably just as they were in Scripture. Angels in rhinestones and feathers and so on. It was very festive. It was very, really very, very lovely. And people drove up and parked and came in drinking hot chocolate and stood around this scene. The wise men brought gifts of coffee and figs and chocolate and cookies, which the BVM and the BVJ really enjoyed. And it was a beautiful scene. It's a beautiful scene as the sun went down, and people just walked right into the nativity scene. There was no fence or anything. They just walked right in, and they talked to the BVM and the BVJ, and it was lovely until the fire siren went off, and then two of the wise men had to run for it, and some men who were watching as well, and they dispersed and. Sister Arvon was there, and people were wondering, well, how does this end? Where does this end? What's the end of the story? Well, there's no curtain to come down. They're right there in our midst. What's the end of the story? Well, that's something we've been trying to figure out for 2,000 years, isn't it? So finally, Sister Arvon just motioned to everybody to sing. So they sang O Holy Night. That's how it ended. Where all the women are strong, all the men are good looking, and all the children are above average.